You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin is a leader in frac sand mining, but that position is being challenged. We'll hear how the booming frac sand industry in Texas could make it difficult for Wisconsin's mines to compete.
First, Foxconn has been everywhere in Wisconsin's news lately. The Taiwanese electronics giant is planning to build an LCD factory somewhere in southeastern Wisconsin. One of the questions raised by the potential development is what demand that factory might make on the resources of Lake Michigan.
Scott Gordon wrote about this issue for WisContext, where he's an associate editor. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, when I think of electronics and display manufacturing, which this Foxconn thing is, one thing I don't usually think about is water, but it turns out I should. Water is a big deal here.
Yes, it takes a lot of water to fabricate electronics. And, you know, obviously we don't know all the details about what exactly would be happening at this proposed plant, but there's been a lot of talk about manufacturing LCD screens and, you know, fabricating the components is a way different matter environmentally than just, say, you know, assembling components that are made overseas. It would use millions of gallons of water per day, a plant of this scale.
What is all that water actually doing in a plant like this?
Well, one thing that a lot of water gets used for in electronics manufacturing, is just keeping the components pristine. You know, when you're making an LCD screen or, you know, a computer chip or anything, you're essentially kind of layering a bunch of things on top of each other, and you want all of those layers to be clean. So things have to be kind of washed over and over again.
And this is southeastern Wisconsin, right near Lake Michigan. So that theoretically could be a source for all this water.
Yeah, and it seems more than likely that that is where they would try to get it from. They could obviously try to have a high-capacity groundwater well out there, but that would also be very controversial. You know, they would be kind of at odds with surface water needs and farmers and other industries and communities out there if they tried to go the groundwater route.
And again, we're talking about a hypothetical factory. We don't know exactly what it would be doing, but people are trying to guesstimate how much water would be required. What kind of numbers are being thrown around?
Well, I talked to one analyst who's followed the whole kind of displays making world for a long time, and he was estimating something on the order of, you know, 15 million gallons of water per day. And I mean, to put that in perspective, that's, you know, that's around what a modest-sized city uses per day, you know, probably a little more than what the whole city of Racine uses in a day.
Now, I can't just go to the shores of Lake Michigan and start taking out water on a large scale. We have this Great Lakes Compact. What would Foxconn have to do? And I understand it depends exactly where they are, but what would they have to do to get access to that water?
Well, like you said, it depends on where they are. Essentially, there's, you know, a line around the Great Lakes Basin, and where you are in relation to that makes all the difference. If you are squarely within the borders of the Great Lakes Basin, and you know you're a city water utility, then you can access Lake Michigan water if you kind of follow all the requirements that the state lays out, more or less. If you're outside of it, but you're in a county that straddles the basin, you can apply for access, but that requires a whole review, you know, the same thing that the city of Waukesha recently went through, where the governors of the 8 Great Lakes states have to unanimously grant you permission. So, that could be a very complex process. I'm sure that they have that in mind and are going to try to probably locate it in a place that is convenient for that whole water thing and, you know, steers them around the possible, you know, years of wrangling they'd have to do.
That's right. Waukesha, this process, successful, ultimately took years to make it happen. Presumably Foxconn, we're not reading their minds, presumably they're not wanting to start an 8-year process to get access to the water they need to open the factory.
Right. And, I mean, the interesting thing is they want to have this open and running by 2020. And, you know, Waukesha isn't hoping to start turning on the taps for Lake Michigan water until, I think, 2023. And Waukesha is only using, only planning to use about 8.2 million gallons per day. So Foxconn would be using more and getting it a lot sooner, in theory.
There's a bill in the legislature in the works trying to create incentives for Foxconn, including relaxing, apparently, some environmental regulations. would that have an impact on this water question?
Yeah, it would. You know, if they're locating this within the Great Lakes Basin, basically the state would be kind of relaxing a lot of the review requirements that that it would have to go through. And so that's kind of changing something where the state already has some discretion. Again, you know, one state cannot unilaterally change this compact because it's an agreement among eight different states and has, you know, all these other ramifications for the region and, you know, relations with Canada and so forth. But yes, the incentives bill does relax a ton of environmental restrictions that a company would normally have to go through.
Talking to Scott Gordon from WisContext, looking at Foxconn and Great Lakes Water. Foxconn might want to use Lake Michigan water for this proposed factory, this manufacturing plant. Scott, I would think that some water, if used for cleaning off these little screens, some of it could end up being recycled and sent back into the waterways. Is that a possibility?
Yes, it is. And, you know, under the compact, you're supposed to return most of what you're using to the Great Lakes watershed. So obviously there would probably have to be a fair amount of treatment for that to be possible in a case like this. But there would also be undoubtedly some consumptive use, which is, you know, you're going to be taking out more than you're able to just put back, just given the nature of this manufacturing process and how it uses up water. But yeah, that would be, you know, something that they would have to do under the compact to some extent.
You talked to some people who work on conservation issues for the Great Lakes. Are they worried about the amount of water that Foxconn could be pulling out here?
Well, it seems like they are. And it seems like the bigger issue that some people are anticipating is that more companies will come to the Midwest in part because we have this tremendous freshwater resource. You know, the Great Lakes are 1/5 of the surface freshwater available in the world. And if you're a water-intensive industry and you're looking at a world where many parts of the United States and many parts of the world in general are really struggling with the sustainability of water resources, the Great Lakes region is going to look pretty good. So I think just as people were worried about, well, what if there's a bunch of Waukeshas trying to tap into the Great Lakes from outside the basin, there's some concern over what if there are a bunch of Foxconns that want to try to do this.
Right. The idea being, well, if Foxconn gets these exemptions or these regulations relaxed, why can't my electronics manufacturing plant or my bottling company or whatever? There's concern, it sounds like, that this could open the door to a lot more use of Lake Michigan water.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a bit ironic in a historical context because one of the reasons that we have this Great Lakes Compact and you know, all these agreements around the Great Lakes is, you know, kind of the fear of outsiders tapping in and stealing that resource. You know, back in the late 90s, there was a big controversy over this company in Canada that wanted to pump out a bunch of water and ship it to China. And, you know, now we have formidable multinational companies from Asia moving in to use that resource, but by coming to us instead of shipping it out of the region.
So what are you watching for in the future when it comes to the Great Lakes Compact and Foxconn's proposal?
I guess the big, big variable is just precisely where it is. And that's on kind of a minute level when you think about it. You know, when you look at how the basin border kind of runs through Racine and Kenosha counties, where they're thinking of putting this factory, it's tough to guess exactly where it will fall in relation to that. Although, I mean, more than likely, they have to be thinking kind of strategically about that.
Because it could be a case where if I build here, I just need a waiver from the state. If I build two blocks that way, I need all eight governors to sign on.
Exactly.
We'll leave it there for now. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks very much, Rob.
That was Scott Gordon, associate editor of WisContext. You can find a link to the WisContext piece on Foxconn and the Great Lakes Compact over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Wisconsin is an industry leader in frac sand mining. Our state is known for its high-quality northern white sand, which is shipped to oil and gas operations around the country for hydraulic fracturing or fracking. The sand is mixed with fluids and used to blast through rock and access fuel reserves.
However, the latest boom in frac sand mining is happening in Texas. Proposed facilities there have the advantage of being a short drive from the oil fields that use that sand. They could pose a challenge to mines here in Wisconsin.
Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire, and he's been reporting on the frac sand industry in Wisconsin and beyond. Rich, great to have you back.
Great to be here.
So, Texas, Rich, what is going on in Texas?
There is a lot of money going into Texas sand, specifically around the Monahan area, Kermit, Texas. Basically, a lot of companies, including companies that have big footprints in Wisconsin, are pumping hundreds of millions of dollars into building sand mines down there, which are, as you mentioned, within driving distance from the busiest oil fields in the country right now. So we're talking about sand mines that are as big or bigger than what we have in Wisconsin, which one of the plants, I think it's U.S. Silica, can produce up to 4 million tons of finished sand each year. So that's much more than any plant in Wisconsin can do.
So the location is ideal, and the output seems like it rivals or exceeds Wisconsin's. But beyond that, why is this happening now?
Well, money, it's all about cost. So the a couple of things are happening. Right now, demand for sand is outstripping producers' abilities to supply it. So there's, right now, sand mines in Wisconsin and everywhere are basically going 24/7 to try to supply the needs of these companies that do the drilling. But the other thing that's happening is that companies are learning that the sand that they get from Texas isn't as poor a quality as was once thought. The legend was, you know, just years ago, that Wisconsin sand is the strongest, the roundest, you know, the purest, and that's still the case. But a lot of the companies have learned that they can use finer grain Texas sand and achieve similar results. The way I understand it, the only places where Wisconsin sand is absolutely needed, according to some of my sources, is very deep wells where you need a really high crush strength. But these companies are figuring out that they can use this cheaper product, and cheaper, we're talking $50 to $70 a ton less than what it costs to bring sand from Wisconsin. So right now, all the money is in Texas.
So before this Texas boom, where did Wisconsin stand when it came to the frac sand industry?
Oh, we were number one, and we were by far the biggest producer. And we talk about Northern White as if it's only in Wisconsin. There are sand mines that produce pretty much the same sand that we have here in Missouri, other parts kind of along the Mississippi River Valley. But we were tops because at that time, nobody really realized that you could use this other sand. Also, our infrastructure, you know, the number of mines exploded, so there was a large supply. And when oil prices were at their peak, and this is summer of 2014, and before that, 2013, 2014, the oil prices were so high that every place that could drill for oil was drilling. And so our sand was going to Texas, it was going to North Dakota, it was going to Pennsylvania, it was going everywhere you could think of. Then we saw a downturn in the price of oil, the demand for drilling, the number of rigs went way down, and the demand for frac sand crashed. And that's when the companies that were still drilling down in Texas started looking at the local supplies, and that's when we started seeing the shift.
And we saw closures here in Wisconsin of frac sand mine operations after that the bottom dropped out on the frac sand prices. Has it seen a comeback since then?
Yeah, the 2015 and 2016 were tough years for the industry as a whole nationwide, but also for Wisconsin, because when oil prices are low, you know, you're not going to have a very big profit margin. So going for that more expensive sand from Wisconsin didn't really make a lot of sense. So yeah, there were plant closures, and it hurt pretty bad for a little while, but then the number of oil prices seemed to have stabilized around $50 a barrel in 2016. Investors started putting more money into drilling operations. We saw the number of rigs go up, especially in what's called the Permian Basin, which is in Texas. And then, you know, the demand has gotten to a point now, and it took most of 2016 and the first half of of 2017 to really bounce back. But right now, the demand is way up at levels we haven't seen for years.
Now, frac sand mining is not without controversy. We saw a lot of protests in some sites here in Wisconsin that in some cases slowed things down or even halted development for a while. Since the industry seems to be so new in Texas, is that something that could also be a hurdle in Texas?
It's a different ball game. The down in Texas, you know, they've lived with the oil industry for a long time, so a lot of places seem to understand that this is kind of the bread and butter. Jobs are hard to come by, and especially where these mines are coming online, there's not much population. So it seems to be pretty easy to get the permits that are necessary down there, just because this is based on how fast. Like, U.S. Silica went from proposal to mining within, I think it was something like 6 months, which is impossible to do here in Wisconsin for whatever reason.
Talking to Rich Kramer right now, WPR reporter based in Eau Claire, and he's with us to talk about why a wave of new frac sand mines in Texas, a lot of them, could provide a lot of competition for mines here in Wisconsin. And Rich, you mentioned that this boom is very concentrated in Texas. A lot of these operations are opening up pretty close to each other, pretty close to their destination in extracting this oil from the ground. Could that raise any structural problems in that everybody's trying to use the same roads and the same infrastructure to get where they're going?
Absolutely. It depends on who you ask. One of my sources is Kent Severson. He is at UW-Eau Claire. He's the chair of the geology department there. And he told me that all of these mines, you know, all these mines are going to be sending a huge amount of trucks down the same roads. And these are small, you know, county highway kind of roads. It's not, there's no big interstate going between the sand mines and the oil fields at this point. So he said that it'll cause a real bottleneck. But I just spoke recently with someone who tracks the stock prices and the industry down in Texas. And he said, quote, if you throw enough money at a bottleneck, the bottleneck disappears. So that's the mindset that they're going into this situation with.
So working with this idea that this boom in Texas could mean a run for the money in frac sand business here in Wisconsin, does that also mean we have to be on the lookout for an impact on the Wisconsin economy and jobs?
Well, you know, of course, the people that are doing business here in Wisconsin, I talked with the Wisconsin Industrial Sand Association today, and they're saying that they're just, you know, no, they don't have a crystal ball. They're being guarded in what they say. Of course, they're not going to say it's going to hurt business, but they said it has the potential to impact the mines in Wisconsin. But what you're seeing is companies that have been mining sand for 100 years in Wisconsin, like Badger Mining, they're opening a new plant in Texas. They're going to where the customers are. And also, it's not that Wisconsin sand is not useful. The general idea that I'm hearing is that Wisconsin sand is well-positioned to go to North Dakota and the Marcellus shale deposits, which is over in the Pennsylvania area. So there are still markets for the sand, what my sources are telling me. But the problem is that these markets aren't growing. The number of drilling rigs in these basins isn't growing at nearly the pace of what we're seeing in Texas.
So, Rich, as you watch this, and you've been watching the frac sand industry in Wisconsin in particular for a while and the health of it, and you've been watching the downturn and maybe the resurgence, what signs are you looking for with an eye on Texas to see what's going to happen here in Wisconsin?
Well, the big question is how many of these. There are 11 planned mines and a total capacity, you know, this is prediction, of up to 50 million tons of sand, but not all of these mines may come online, so we're not sure about that. Also, there's a big conference coming up in September where some of the scientific studies about how strong this Texas sand is are going to be released to the public. A lot of people are going to be watching that, and if the data shows that the sand from Texas is just about as good as Wisconsin, I think you're going to see a big shift in a lot more money going to the Texas sand mining industry than we're seeing in Wisconsin.
And on the flip side, I suppose, if it comes back that the Texas sand is inferior to Wisconsin sand, that could be the reverse for Wisconsin.
It could be. And also, you know, if the oil prices go back up to close to $100 a barrel, all bets are off, because then oil drilling will ramp up in the other parts that Wisconsin sand is better positioned for. So, I mean, we saw in the 2010, 2011, 12, 13, 14, North Dakota just exploded with the number of oil rigs. So if we see oil prices go back up, people will be drilling in their backyards if they have to. So then the demand will outstrip supplies, and Wisconsin will probably fare pretty well.
Rich, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire with us to talk about why a new wave of frac sand mines in Texas could provide stiff competition for frac sand mines here in Wisconsin.
Now, as Republican efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act have broken down and the Trump White House remains tangled with the ongoing Russia investigation, President Trump and House Speaker Paul Ryan have taken a similar approach: appeal to the base.
For Trump, that's meant supporting controversial policies on immigration, transgender officers in the military, and affirmative action.
For Paul Ryan, it means, among other things, a new call for a border wall between Mexico and the U.S.
I had the opportunity to travel down to Texas, to go to the Rio Grande Valley and spend time with our Border Patrol. When you see what they're up against, it really gives you even greater respect for what they do. They clearly need more tools and more support to do their jobs effectively. That's why we're going to get this done this week.
Susan Johnson is an associate professor of political science and the director of the Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research at UW-Whitewater. Susan, great to have you back.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So with the 28 midterms kind of creeping up and the Russia investigation lingering, what kind of shape is the GOP in right now?
Well, I think it's in a bit of a different shape than they thought they would be at this point. If we recall, after the election, the Republicans controlled the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives. And I think that there was an expectation that 6 months in or so, that there would be significant policy victories to point to. And I think that, as you mentioned, with the midterms creeping up in about 15 months or so, there's some concern that perhaps they might be in more trouble than they would have thought.
On the other hand, the GOP has rock-solid control of Congress and the White House, and they've been able to appoint a Supreme Court justice. So are things, you know, really that bad for Republicans?
I would have to say no. I mean, you pointed to the Supreme Court justice. I would also point to the fact that they control many, two-thirds or so of the governors around the country and many of the state legislatures. And given the state of redistricting around the country, it's likely that those numbers are going to remain. And then I would also point to, while I alluded to the fact that there haven't been significant policy victories legislatively, there have been quite a few things that have been done administratively that I think that they can point to in terms of successes, and we can talk about those a bit if you'd like, but I'm thinking about things within the EPA and then specifically in the Department of Justice with Attorney General Sessions.
Right. Tell us more about that. What do you see there as being maybe victories?
Well, I would say, first of all, in regard to the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt, the secretary of that agency, there's been quite a bit of activity in terms of rolling back some of the administrative protections that have been put in place during the Obama administration. So we're seeing an erosion of some of the environmental protections that had been put in place. And then in the Department of Justice, we've seen, under Attorney General Sessions, a tightening and a reshaping, I would say, a reframing of some of the policies in regards to crime prevention, crime enforcement, certainly as it relates to border enforcement and deportations, but also more broadly in terms of issues related to law enforcement and the kinds of things that federal prosecutors are instructed to focus on. So I would say administratively, there's been quite a bit done in that regard.
Right. And in that vein, President Trump gave a talk in New York last week where he had this to say.
And when you see these thugs being thrown into the back of a paddy wagon, you just see them thrown in, rough. I said, please don't be too nice. Like when you guys put somebody in the car and you're protecting their head, you know, the way you put their hand over. Like, don't hit their head and they've just killed somebody, don't hit their head. I said, you can take the hand away, okay?
And Susan, what do you hear in that clip? I mean, it's been controversial. Some people have seen it as a promotion of unlawful use of police force. Is it intended for a particular audience?
Well, I would say first that it was several chiefs of police have come out and indicated that that was not acceptable behavior for law enforcement. So they said this is not what we do. It's also consistent, however, with the kinds of language that we saw at President Trump's rallies during the campaign. So it wasn't necessarily that surprising to me as someone who's watched his campaign rallies over the course of a campaign and even subsequent rallies. But I think it clearly is playing to that idea of law and order that we can go back a full year ago to the convention when that was the theme of the convention and of his speech was returning America to this image of law and order. And apparently in his mind, that type of behavior by police is returning to law and order.
Talking with Susan Johnson right now, an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater, talking about a recent return to re-energize the GOP base by President Trump and also by Paul Ryan. And Susan, we began by listening to a little bit of a video produced for Paul Ryan where he goes to the border between the U.S. and Mexico. He tours it, and you heard the tone of that, and there's a pretty high production value on this. So he's got a pretty passionate call for the border wall happening there. What do you see in that from Paul Ryan?
Well, I mean, I think it's consistent with the message that has resonated quite strongly with a certain segment of the Republican Party, and that's securing our southern border. And so we know that build the wall was a significant theme throughout the 2016 campaign, and we know that in the budgets that are being negotiated or discussed, President Trump's budget and then what Congress is talking about has included significant funding for the border wall. So it's just, to me, it's consistent with what's been discussed over the course of the last year or so.
Isn't it controversial, though? Even among Republicans, there's critiques that it costs too much money and that there's division, even among Republicans along the border, about whether or not this is a good thing, whether or not they may agree with some aims of it and some aspects of it. It's also not without controversy.
Oh, without a doubt. You have controversy coming from several different angles. You have, as you alluded to, some of the fiscal hawks in the party who think that the idea of spending this kind of money on what many people believe would not be an effective tool at securing the border, they see that as being very wasteful in terms of government spending. You have others who look at the fact that we've seen a decrease in undocumented immigration coming over the border, so you can make the argument that perhaps the need for securing the border for that purpose has been minimized. And then I think you also have people in the party who just have a different approach to how we should handle immigration, both legal and illegal. So without a doubt, there's controversy there. But in terms of a certain core base within the Republican Party, it still plays very well. And because if it didn't, you wouldn't have Paul Ryan making that video and you wouldn't have President Trump still talking about it.
Well, let's talk about that base, the base that elected Donald Trump, brought him to office. A lot of white voters is what we've heard, and some without college degrees. Is that base holding?
Well, in some of the most recent polling, what we've seen is that if we're thinking about, you're referencing sort of white voters without college degrees, tends to be how that group is very, very broadly defined. In recent polling, what we've seen is that the number of people in that group who approve of Trump's job performance has fallen. And so in one particular Quinnipiac poll, at the end of June, his support amongst that group was about 40%, and now a month later it's down to about 33%. So, I mean, that's a precipitous drop, and amongst other groups, his approval ratings have gone down as well. And if you look across other presidencies at this point of time, his President Trump's approval ratings are by far the lowest. And, I mean, Gerald Ford is comparable, but there's reasons for that. But others are just much higher at this point in their administration. So I think there's cause for the Republicans to be concerned.
So if some of these recent policy moves that we were just talking about, if they're designed to appeal to this GOP base that may be eroding, is there a danger for Republicans that the intended audience for this is slipping? It could be too narrow and not broad enough to bring more people into the tent.
Well, I think to a certain degree, and I don't know that these are the goal is to bring people into the tent as it is to protect, close the door in the tent, maybe is a better analogy to think about it that way. And going to people with issues that were successful in winning the election in 2016 and trying to reinvigorate that base with those sorts of issues. I mean, the party just took a big hit with their failure to repeal and replace or modify the Affordable Care Act. And so I think there's a natural inclination to want to retreat a bit. And what we're seeing from congressional leadership, I mean, people like Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, and others, he's talking about moving on to tax reform. And you're seeing other leaders in the Senate talking about moving on in that direction. And we're seeing a bit of a different direction from the president. And then the video you alluded to with Paul Ryan suggests he's going in that direction. But Paul Ryan obviously is also interested in tax reform.
Susan Johnson stays with us now. She's an associate professor of political science and the director of the Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research at UW-Whitewater.
And you can join in now at 800-642-1234 if you're a Republican or typically vote Republican. Do you like the focus you're hearing lately from President Trump and Speaker Ryan in the weeks since the health care defeat? Is appealing to the base enough to help Republicans win in 2018? Should Republican policy try to be more attractive to a wider group of voters? Wherever you are on the political spectrum, what do you want to see next from Republican leadership in the White House and Congress? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll have more on this in just a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. With defeats in health care and the ongoing Russia investigation, President Trump and Paul Ryan have been vocal about supporting policies with big appeal to the Republican base, like the border wall, affirmative action, and transgender people in the military. Susan Johnson stays with us now. She's an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 in the aftermath of the Affordable Care Act vote without a change to the Affordable Care Act. Where should Republican leadership in the Senate, in the House, and in the White House go from here? What should the top priority be? Should it be another attempt at health care? Should it be tax reform? Should it be immigration and the border wall? Let us know your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And if you were a supporter of President Trump in the election, do you still like what you're seeing? More? Less? Are you changing your mind? We'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Matt joining us first in Milwaukee. Matt, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm actually more of a libertarian myself, but I just wanted to point out that the basis for a lot of the argument is based on the polls and that the support for President Trump is slipping. But I wanted to make a note and remind folks that the polls leading up to the election, most of them were very, very, very much off and wrong, and a lot of the polls were found to have oversampled Democrats hugely. You know, so who knows what the mistakes are in these current polls, but they're just not to be trusted because they didn't turn out to be very accurate during the lead up to the election. And also that most of Trump supporters don't believe the Russian collusion thing because there has not been any evidence whatsoever for that.
Matt, thanks a lot for calling and for bringing that up. So Matt's saying, you know, we've seen that maybe charting your course by the polls isn't exactly a great thing to do anymore. And it could be there's greater evidence that this is what the Republican base wants to see. And also that the base is bigger and still on board with President Trump. What do you say to that?
I think that Matt has a very good point in the sense that a lot of us who study this and follow the polls were, as he suggested, you know, a bit surprised that the polls did not turn out, that the election did not turn out as the polls would have suggested. So in that case, I would agree with him. But I think that if we're looking at approval ratings over time and looking at shifts in approval ratings, we're still, if we're seeing change and we're looking at the same sort of demographic snapshot, there's a bit more consistency there. And then I would also say we could point to other things beyond just polls are easy to look at, but I think we can point to other things, attendance at town hall meetings, people contacting their member of Congress to express their concern about things. So I think that it's a fair point, though, to be concerned about polls sometimes.
All right. Thanks a lot, Matt, for that call. And we go next to David joining us in Toma. Hi, David.
Hi, good afternoon.
What's on your mind?
My concern is the partisanship with everything that goes on in government today. The Democrats don't appear to be presenting any ideas or any plans, and the Republicans, while some of their ideas are not working out well, they can't get anything accomplished. So you have this near split in the Congress, and they're not accomplishing anything, and you don't hear anything from the Democratic side other than let's get this Russia investigation drummed up and get that stronger. And they don't really have any charges other than some possibilities, but it's utterly shut our government down for the last 6-7 months.
Thanks a lot, David. And Susan, David talking about divided government, which has been kind of the law of the land for the last at least couple few terms there. And wondering what you think about David's thought that he sees the Democrats obstructing and getting in the way and it's stopping anything from getting done, he says.
Well, I mean, I guess I would say in regard to much of what the Republicans can or can't do, they have majorities in, as we said, in both houses of Congress and the presidency. So, I mean, the health care law, not being able to make changes there was a Republican issue. But I would say to the broader point, the Democrats, I think, are trying to get a bit of a message out. It's been a criticism, and I agree with David, that the Democrats have been the party of no Trump, no Trump, and haven't had very much of a message. Within the past few weeks, they tried to change that by coming out with some different policy ideas and different themes that they want to focus on over the course of the next 15 months or so in hopes of actually having a message to put out there to voters. But I think that a lot of the media attention on the Russia stuff, I think much even to the Democrats' chagrin, is drowning out what they're trying to get out there.
On the other hand, a quick note, Susan, I mean, it seemed to work out with some success for Republicans to be the party of opposition and to have that be the prevailing message for the last 8 years before Trump took office.
Right. I mean, famously, Mitch McConnell in 2009 said that their goal in the Senate was to obstruct President Obama. So this is certainly not new. And I mean, this idea of obstructionism and inabilities to get things done, it's been over a dozen years since we've had regular order in terms of passing a budget. So this is by no means something that's new.
We're talking to Susan Johnson, political scientist at UW-Whitewater right now, talking about recent moves to appeal to the GOP base from President Trump and Speaker Ryan. And we'll go back to our callers now. We've got Richard joining us next, coming in from Milwaukee. Richard, hi.
Hi. I have a question about the drop in support for Republicans in the wake of the health care votes. Do the polls ask people why their support dropped? In my case, it went way down, not because the bills passed, but because they tried to push through bills that were so horrible to begin with.
Okay, Richard, thanks for that. Susan, your take.
I mean, I think you've got to do a deeper dive into some of the data to get at that, because that's a very good point. Sometimes polls just simply ask, do you support, are you in favor or in opposition of the Affordable Care Act? And you might have some people who think it doesn't go far enough. You might have some that think it went too far. So I haven't seen yet, and I'm assuming we will at some point, but I haven't seen a very careful look at how the public opinion in regard to the health care, in terms of the response to what happened over the course of the last 10 days, has really shaken out. But it's a good point that he makes.
And Susan, we started talking about this appeal to the base, about policy support for clamping down on immigration, restricting transgender people in the military, about keeping an eye out in the Justice Department for infractions when it comes to affirmative action. All of that, if it does energize the base, does it also run the risk of leaving some Republican House members in more competitive districts vulnerable?
I would think that it could. I mean, because some of these issues, if we just pick up one, and that's the idea of the president's wanting to ban transgender people from the military. If you look at the polls broadly, there's support for the rights of transgendered people, and we've come, you know, quite a ways over the course of the past decade or so in that regard. There's still ways to go, but we've come quite a ways, and there is the possibility in some of those swing districts where the voting base is a bit more moderate than some of the stronger Republican areas where it could become an issue. But I would argue that it has to be the most salient issue necessarily for someone to maybe swing them from one party to another.
And we leave it there. Susan, great to have you on.
Thank you.
That was Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research at UW-Whitewater, joining us there to talk about a recent move following a healthcare defeat for Republicans, recent move to appeal to the GOP base, seeing that with President Trump and also Speaker Paul Ryan.
You can share your thoughts still on the Central Time Facebook page.